For the week of December 29th, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 474, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. You know, I had a Yeti microphone, a blue microphone for podcasting. I put it through the washer and dryer, which isn't recommended. So eventually I got a new one. I have a new one. And now toothpaste exploded all over it in the suitcase. So I have a blue microphone with toothpaste on it, and I'm afraid to wipe it off because I'm afraid water will get in and damage this one.
You can do it with a Q-tips, actually.
Well, it's on the grill, so I'll try. Q-tips will just get hair stuck in it, won't it?
Oh, I see. Yeah, I don't know. If you do it very softly, usually that grill is on the outside of a condenser microphone, so you should be okay. I wouldn't put it underwater, but no. You could definitely wipe it off with like a damp cloth.
All right. Well,
but the good news is I bet you that your microphone smells fantastic.
Oh, it's got the best breath in town.
Minty breath.
So that was my Christmas gift to me a little while ago. Mariah Carey just got another Christmas gift because her song, All I Want for Christmas, is still number one through the holiday season. So it's number one now for the chart in January of 2020. And if you have a hit like in 2019 into 2020 or 2009 to 2000, you get to have a hit in two decades. So when you talk about all those decades, you know, historic achievements, Mariah Carey is now the first artist in history to have a number one song on the Billboard Hot 100 in four different decades. I bet Bing Crosby did that pre-Billboard Hot 100, but Mariah Carey has done it. She's had hits in the 90s, the noughts, the 10s, and now the 20s.
But here's my question. How many of them has she lip sunk to on New Year's Eve?
One.
Okay.
She can sing, boy. Don't taunt her about that. She's got a 20 octave range.
A 20 octave? There are not even 20 octaves in the... Oh, there are 20 octaves, but still, like 8 octaves is generally considered, you know, the piano, right?
Mariah Carey can go up, she can go down, but you can tell us what's going to be on this week's show.
I'm not even going to touch that whole up and down thing, but I will tell you.
Did you have a good Christmas? A good holiday?
Yeah, you know, I had a good Christmas. How about you?
I did. The family was all together and we didn't fight.
Did you get my Christmas card? Did you get my Christmas card?
Of course. I loved it.
Okay. I know. Are you being serious? Because I just sent it to an address that I had. I was like, I don't know. I think this is where Michael is. And I sent it off. I have no idea where he is right now.
I don't know. I wasn't sure if you were serious. I don't know.
It's got a picture of two girls on it. It was sent to some place on Country Club Road.
Well, that's the place. That's the place.
Okay.
So was it sent late?
No. It was sent on time.
Oh, it must have been adorable, and I loved it.
Oh, my gosh. Well, in any case, while Michael goes to look for my Christmas card, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we take a look at the presents under the tree for Hollywood. Record international box office. That's what we have. Perhaps record worldwide box office and second biggest domestic box office of all time.
Woohoo!
Plus fruitcake. I don't know what that's a reference to, but I love the fact that it's in there. In China, they unwrapped another 8,800 movie screens in the Middle Kingdom, bringing its grand total to a titch under 69,000 screens in all. And most of the hits playing on those screens are Chinese films. And by the way, that's just the way they like it. On Inside Baseball, we chat about Facebook and YouTube and why they both decided to sort of sit out the streaming wars. Sure, they're making original content, but hey, it's all about their platforms, not launching some fancy new and very expensive media empire. They will gladly leave that to the Apples and the Amazons and the Peacocks and the HBO Maximuses of the world. Thank you very much. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from everywhere else. And then we do our own math to come up with our own unique chart. Nobody else does this. Well, some of them do. It's catching on, truly. I've seen it in a Chinese chart. I've seen it on Box Office Mojo. They're starting to prevent a full week's worth of information on box office grosses. And if you come to our site, you'll find out that the number one movie around the world with Star Wars, Rise of Skywalker, $350 million last week, $725 million worldwide. So it's doing great. Now, the way Christmas fell, this year. It looked like it was off to a bit of a slow start. It was down significantly from the last film, like 20%, but now it's caught up. The word of mouth is fine among fans. They're happy. The movie's doing great. This is going to easily, I think, hit the $1.3 billion of The Last Jedi, which is the previous film in the franchise. So
you know, here's the thing. Christmas fell at such a weird time this year. There was a shorter distance between Thanksgiving, which I know is not celebrated in every country. Mm-hmm. But between Thanksgiving and Christmas, there was like one fewer weekends. So people had less time to get everything done and to plan travel and to get to wherever they were going. There was just less time to do everything. And so I think people like me decided, hey, you know what? Let's hold off on seeing Star Wars this weekend, even though it's the first weekend. Let's go see it next week, maybe Christmas Day or the day after Christmas or when everybody's off over the weekend after that.
That's right. And if the buzz was bad or you just weren't that thrilled about seeing it, it might have hobbled it seriously where a good placed week holiday might have helped it. So in this case, it overcame that modest hurdle and became a big hit. And if you look at all nine films and the two spinoffs, meaning Rogue One and Han Solo, you look at all of them, you can see trilogy by trilogy how they do. They all have a slightly different pattern. It's funny to be reminded, I'd sort of forgotten, that Star Wars was so massive, Empire Strikes Back dropped fairly significantly. It still made a ton of money, but like 20, 30. And then Return of the Jedi was below that. So it's sort of a classic trilogy, you know, one after the other, making less than the one before. That didn't work with the second three. The third one made a lot of money. And now in the third three, we have the first movie making so much money and the second two about the same. If you look at all of it and Rogue One grossing $1 billion, the only message to take from Han Solo and that movie is they didn't make a very good movie. It's so wildly underperformed from the others. But with Rogue One and this one doing really well, you know, I don't think the problem was that they made a Star Wars every year. I think there's just that one film wasn't that good. People keep coming back. But there is a 10 to 15 year gap between each trilogy. So if they can show a little patience and wait 5 or 8 or 10 years before launching some brand new thing, they'll have good pent up demand again.
Well, and if you think about it, you can take the Star Trek route. And I hate to compare Star Trek and Star Wars. I'm only doing that because one is a TV show and the other is a movie. And of course, Star Trek had movies, and then they, you know, they kind of spaced out their movies. But in the meantime, they had TV shows. And if you look at Mandalorian, that's kind of what they're starting to do now, right?
They've had multiple TV shows, most of them animated and quite good, actually. And now Mandalorian on Disney Plus, and everyone I know who has seen it thinks it's pretty good.
You know, speaking of pretty good, I saw the film Star Wars Rise of Skywalker. Mm-hmm. That is not the word I would use for Star Wars Rise of Skywalker. Pretty good is not, those two words I would not put, you know, here's the thing. I watched it and I was like, I think I'm, you know, I get it. I get, yeah, Yeah, all right, okay.
I felt pretty indifferent. The one I liked was Rogue One of the last five movies. That's the one I actually kind of enjoyed. I thought it had a nice dark tone to it. Dirty Dozen sort of, you know, feel for doomed people sacrificing all for the greater good. I liked Rogue One, but people are happy.
My kids
are happy.
Saw Rise of Skywalker and they were like, we don't get what was going on in this movie.
Had they seen the others?
Yes, they had. Ah. They had, and they had seen them recently too because they wanted to catch up and just remind themselves. But the reality is there's just too much going on.
Well,
there's just
fans disagree because it's a hit, big hit all over the world. And our in-house film critic, Aaron Rich, said, I liked it.
Oh, okay.
So there you go. That's the number one movie around the world, though. It's doing great. $725 million. I'm sure it will get to $1.3 billion, just like Last Jedi. We'll have to see where it ends up. At number two around the world.
Well, you know what? If it doesn't, you can blame Ewoks. Ewoks were both in Return of the Jedi and Episode 10 or 9 or whatever we're up to now.
Well, okay. Well, I'll blame the Ewoks, though. I wouldn't blame them to their face. You know, and it did it all without China, of course. It's doing very poorly in China, but don't feel bad, Star Wars. Downton Abbey opened up in China, and it did poorly, too. At number two around the world is, just this week, it opened up. At number two around the world is Jumanji, The Next Level, the Dwayne Johnson movie. $160 million this week. It's at $470 million worldwide, just about $500 million so far. It's going to get to $900 million, a billion, just like the last one. Looks like it. And number three is Frozen 2. That made another $114 million. That's playing really strongly throughout the holiday season. Obviously, Cats has not proven to be a family-friendly show. Spies in Disguise, which we'll get to in a minute, is really playing only to kiddies. So Frozen 2 has had a wide open space for family-friendly movie people. $1,217 million worldwide.
Now, you saw Frozen 2, correct?
I did not.
You did not. I did. I did go see it over the weekend. Finally caught up with all these movies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't really know why that movie exists, but, you know. Okay.
The first one made $1 billion. At number
Okay, you're right. Other than that, I don't, like, artistically, I don't know why it exists.
At number four is Ip Man 4, the finale. That made another $60 million this week. It's at $111 million worldwide. Now, at number five, we have an original film. It's called Spies in Disguise, that animated movie from Blue Sky. So when Disney bought Fox, they gobbled up the last movies from Blue Sky, the people who did Ice Age and stuff like that. They're usually made on the cheap, but you can see the budgets rising for all of them. So given the involvement of Will Smith and Tom Holland, I'm just guessing wildly that this movie probably cost at least $100 million, which is what the last two or three movies from Blue Sky cost. And with those names attached, I have to imagine that's the deal. It made $38 million on its opening week. It's doing okay with kiddies. We'll have to see how it plays out. Not good reviews, but that's not the case for Little Women. The Greta Gerwig film opened up very strongly for a family-friendly drama. $35 million in its opening week, playing well. Oscar buzz is back now that it's got a good box office story to tell. We'll have to see where it ends up, but this looks like a very strong start.
And you know what's really interesting to me is the reviews from male men love this film.
There you go. I haven't seen it yet. My mom wants to see it, and I'm waiting for her.
Yeah, I'd like to see it as well.
Yeah, I'm going to see Uncut Gems and Little Women and Bombshell sometime in the next week or two.
By the way, you want to talk about a great marketing campaign for Uncut Gems. I know this is a bit of an aside. So President Obama, or former President Obama, I don't know. I guess he's always president, right?
Yeah.
President Obama. He every year publishes these lists. The books I like this year, the songs I like, I'm listening to. He did movies, okay? And two of the 10 or 12 movies on the list are from A24, this distribution company that is distributing Uncut Gems.
Uh-huh.
And so what they did is they did this whole social media campaign of, you know what, he just hasn't seen Uncut Gems yet. And so there was
You mean
all
before
these,
he did his list?
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
You're so, confusing people. You didn't do that right.
Yeah, okay. Well, I don't
You said before Obama saw the film and said I loved it, they said he hasn't seen it yet or it would be on his list. And then did he change his list or
No, he didn't change his list, but they basically said even though it didn't make the list, two of their other films did, which they were highlighting the fact that two of their other films did.
Oh, one of them wasn't Uncut Gems.
One of them wasn't Uncut Gems, and they were like, the only reason it wasn't on that we didn't have three on the list is because he hasn't seen Uncut Gems yet. Because of course once he has Well, of course.
So has he seen it yet? Or is that still, that just came out the list, right?
Yeah,
okay,
exactly.
So to clarify, Obama put out his best list of the favorite films and TV shows of the year. He also does books and music. And Uncut Gems wasn't on it. And A24 said, we got two movies on the list. And the only reason Uncut Gems isn't on there is because he hasn't seen it yet. So what you're saying is they sent out a tweet. It's not that big of a social media campaign. They sent out a tweet and posted it on Facebook. Good for them.
You know, if you could just follow me around and just clarify everything I'm saying, actually, yes. Believe it or not, I know that most listeners will think I'm joking. It would actually help me.
Honey, what I meant was that dress is very flattering and it does make your thighs look thin.
Exactly what he said.
At number seven is Sheep Without a Shepherd. That's the Chinese crime drama about a family trying to cover up a child who had accidentally killed a violent rapist. You know, they had to cover it up. $34 million it made this week. That, too, is at about $111 million worldwide. Then there's Knives Out, the Rian Johnson flick, which now people are saying, Oscar? Maybe it'll get a screenwriting nomination, and who knows? It's a catnip for Hollywood because they love seeing a bunch of big-name stars camping it up and having fun, and that's certainly the case with Knives Out. It made another $30 million. It's at $215 million worldwide. And then there was Cats. Cats is simply not doing well. It's opening up in a lot of territories now. It's at $27 million this week, $38 million worldwide. But everywhere it's playing, it's getting very poor reviews from critics and very poor reviews from audience goers. Not a happy movie. And didn't our friend, one of our longtime listeners, wrote in about this movie, didn't they?
Yes, James Gardner. So I guess let me just jump down
it's
here
right
to our
there.
Listener.
It's in the email. Notes. It's notes right up here.
Oh, okay. He said about Cats, I read it may have been a genitalia issue that did not go down well, and they removed them.
So that's the scuttlebutt on the extra special effects they were adding in?
Yeah, exactly. They were kind of removing some extra special effects, if you know what we mean. Yeah, so he says, check that for the next episode. Obviously, we can't check that. But also, it's also not going well or considered a flop in Australia from what he has heard from...
It is considered a flop.
Yes, it is definitely considered a flop in Australia. He's heard that from some of the other
cinemas. Now, this is interesting. He says some people will go back to Universal to renegotiate their policy. Which policy is that? The regional
rental policy. The rental. They'll basically say, hey, remember... Yeah, exactly. Remember when you said, well, it'll either be rates, so it'll either be, hey, Universal, you wanted 55%? Why don't we say 50? Or vice versa. Or, hey, you know how you said we had to keep it for 4 weeks? Why don't we say 2? You said how we had to play it clean without splitting the screen with another film? We're going to start splitting the screen. So they'll start negotiating.
Doesn't that happen? I mean, negotiate makes it sound so complicated. When a movie's a flop, the studio understands and says, yeah, of course, right?
Remember that block booking stuff we talked about?
Yeah.
Yeah. The theater that does that says, hey, yeah, Universal, your film's a flop, okay? I'm going to take it off the screen after a week.
And
guess what
mind?
Happens the next time Jurassic World 9 comes out? Yeah, they tend not to get a print.
So they want you to keep a movie that's empty with theaters on not split screening it, really? They wouldn't say you can show Cats, you know, noon and 2 and 3 and then show Uncut Gems or some adult film at like 8 and 10 p.m.? They would
in the
really,
third or fourth week, they would probably do that, but not in the second week.
And he also says Universal does not allow many small cinemas to play their content until 6 weeks out. Now, if there's no competitors for the small cinemas, why would they have such a ban?
Oh, there's clearances. There's so many different reasons. It's not a ban. It's so much as
they won't give it to them.
They just won't give it to them, right? They don't. They want their films playing in specific houses.
Well, of course, but if you're in the hinterlands and there's no specific big house nearby, I'm assuming small cinemas exist in areas where there aren't big cinemas.
Yeah, and I can't speak for why that's taking place in Australia. I can speak for what that is like in
North America,
in the U.S. And basically, it has everything to do with per screen average.
So James Gardner is saying, you know what? They're going to make me wait six weeks before I can show the film. And I've heard it's a big flop. I'm probably not going to show it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'd say, James, you're making a very wise move.
Thanks for weighing in and letting us know about all that, James. I appreciate it. The scuttlebutt about the genitalia having to be erased. That's a lot of fun. We'll have to see.
Right. And James did write into dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter, @ShowbizSandbox is our handle, and you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. And I interrupted you when you were talking about genitalia, Michael. I'm sorry. Please continue.
You jumped the gun. I was going to use that in a minute. But anyway, at number 10 around the world is Uncut Gems from A24, of course, though Netflix has it for the rest of the world. But in North America, A24 is releasing the film. That grossed $20 million this week. That seems like a lot of money to me for Uncut Gems. And that's 5 times as much as their last film, Good Time, which I quite liked, grossed during its entire run.
Well, a couple things. It's getting a ton of great buzz. It's got Adam Sandler.
Well, it's not. Audiences are seeing it, and they're hating the ending, actually.
They're really kind
of thrown off by the movie. They go to see them, and they're like, what? So I haven't seen the film yet, but they are sort of, critics are liking it, but audiences are sort of split. It's a little bit divisive. And, of course, it's Adam Sandler. He's the star, and you could have scoffed at the movies he made for Netflix and how junky they are. But guess what? Netflix just announced that the most popular movie of the year all over the world for Netflix was Adam Sandler's murder mystery with Jennifer Aniston. This junky, goofy, dumb title. And you know what? People lapped it up. So when he releases a film like this, a small, gritty, dark film, he brought a lot of people to the movie theaters.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, especially given a dramatic role where they see the trailer and they're like, actually, I kind of want to see that. Certainly, it is one of the highest grossing films and the highest grossing weeks that A24, the distribution company we've previously mentioned, has ever had.
It could have been $20 million and $12, but Obama can't get off his butt and go see it. All right.
Yeah. By the way, do you want to know some of the films that are on his list, or you don't care?
Sure.
Okay, well, everything from American Factory, which is on Netflix. And by the way, I think, doesn't he have something to do with American Factory?
I think he's a producer.
Yeah, or he picked it. Yeah, he like lent his name. Apollo 11, Amazing Grace. Of course, the documentary about Aretha Franklin. Ash is Purest White from China. Atlantiques from, I want to say it's Senegal. Birds of Passage from Colombia. Booksmart. Diane, The Farewell. Great movie. Ford versus Ferrari. The Irishman. Just Mercy, The Last Black Man in San Francisco, Little Women, Marriage Story, Parasite, The Souvenir, and Transit.
Well, some solid, interesting movies.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'd say so. First of all, how does he have time to watch all these movies?
Well, he's not president anymore. And Atlantix is indeed Senegalese. Okay. At number 11 around the world is Dabang 3, an Indian action comedy flick. It grossed $14 million this week. It's at $24 million worldwide. It's playing locally here in Birmingham, Alabama, along with Good News, a movie that's further down the chart. Good News, that's a Hindi comedy about two couples who go for in vitro fertilization and the sperm gets swapped and hilarity ensues. That movie grossed about $8 million this week. But both of those movies are playing in North America, and yet they do not appear on any chart. They're not on Box Office Mojo. I can't find them anywhere else. I don't know why they, I assume they must have grossed something. They're very popular in India, I'm sure. I was looking for them to be in the top 20 or something, but they're not, they don't have a single dollar registered. I'm not quite sure what happened there because we're used to seeing films from India popping up on the North American charts quite, you know, significantly on its opening weeks.
And this is Dabang 3. That's what
and,
that's about.
And Good News.
And Good News.
Yes, okay. Yes, which the other movie I just described. Dabang 3 is the action comedy.
Okay, I didn't know which one you were describing.
Dabang
okay.
3 is the Indian action comedy. Again, we talked about it last week. That's where the guy says, there are outlaws and there are cops. I'm an outlaw cop. It's very goofy, okay. Fun action comedy, whereas Good News is a slapsticky comedy about couples trying to have a baby. And both of those are playing in North America, but they're not on the charts, which is where I would have then said, hey, if you know why not, let us know. And then Sperling would have said all that information.
Dirt at Sherman. Okay, yes.
And number 12 is Ashfall, the Korean disaster flick where there's a volcano or an earthquake and they're going to use nuclear missiles or bombs of some sort to try and prevent an even bigger disaster. That made $12 million this week. It's at $29 million and counting.
So what you're saying is two explosions, the opposites attract, they'll actually implode?
Sometimes two explosions do make a right.
Okay.
At number 13 is Almost a Comedy, the Chinese comic romantic drama that made $11 million this week. It's at $18 million and counting. Bombshell, that's the film about Fox News. It opened up wider this week in North America. It's struggling a bit. It made $11 million at the box office. It's at $16 million and counting. The movie only costs $32 million to make, so it's going to be fine, I think, when all is said and done. But this is not a great start for the movie. It had sort of Oscar buzz, and now it's sort of stumbling at the box office, and people who are seeing it are kind of going, eh, it's okay. Though I've heard quite good things about...
Charlize Theron?
Yeah.
Margot Robbie?
Charlize Theron playing Megyn Kelly, being really uncanny in her embodiment of Megyn Kelly. So that's kind of fun. I'll go see it. But my expectations are a little lower.
This is one of those movies that frankly, you could wait to see. It almost screams...
That's why I have a movie pass, so I don't care.
Oh, you don't have a movie pass.
I do. I have
an A-list member. You are a Stubbs A-list.
I have $25 a month, so I can see as many movies. I can see three movies a week, which is more than I need. So there you go. And number 15 around the world is Only Cloud Knows, the Chinese tearjerker that is set in New Zealand. That made $10 million. It's at $21 million worldwide. A couple of these movies, including, I think, Dabang 3. And with Dabang 3, was that on the chart? No, see, Dabang 3 was not on the ComScore chart. Neither was...
Good News.
Neither was Good News. Neither was this film, Almost a Comet, Only Cloud Knows. Those are movies that I found by looking at the Chinese charts, looking at the Bollywood charts, or I should say Indian movie charts. I beg your pardon. It's called Bollywood.com or something, but they're not all Bollywood films. So these are movies we're putting in. As far as we can tell, this is what they grossed this week. There's an asterisk by them, but you know, these things fall through the cracks if they're not reporting them to ComScore. So we're doing our best to stay on top. If you ever see a movie and, hey, this should have been on the charts or we're not knowing about it, you know, let us know at that address. Anyway, Only Cloud Knows, Chinese tearjerker, $10 million this week. Good News, that Hindi comedy, that made $8 million this week, just like last Christmas. I assume this movie will fall off the cliff next week because Christmas season is over, but it is now at $118 million worldwide. It's certainly profitable. Way to go, Emma Thompson. We'll have to see if this becomes a holiday favorite. It may be Hallmark will show it on their channel. I kind of don't think it's going to enter the pantheon. It's too oddball, but I'm still going to check it out. At number 18 is an Italian film, Il Primo Natale. It's that Italian time travel Christmas movie that we were talking about. That made $7 million. That wasn't on the charts either, But we, no, that one was. That was at the bottom. So that made $7 million last week. It's at $13 million and counting. Just like last Christmas, I assume this holiday theme movie will stop making money next week cold. That's usually what happens. Richard Jewell is a movie they also don't seem to want to see. The Clint Eastwood film, that made $7 million this week. That's at $16 million worldwide. That's another movie that was not on the Comscore charts, but since it was on the charts the week earlier, I said, well, wait a second. These orphans, have they fallen off a cliff? Are they still making money? I went and looked and searched, and as far as I could tell, it made $7 million last week. So it's still on there fighting to get attention, but it's not looking well for Clint Eastwood. At number 20 is a new film. It's from Brazil. It's called My Mom is a Character 3. This is part of a series. It stars Brazil's, it's sort of a Brazilian Madea, and it's created and starring Paulo Gustavo. And in the movie, Donna Herminia must deal with her gay son getting married and her daughter, who's an actress, getting pregnant. Hilarity ensues. And that movie,
yeah, it's a very well-known comedy.
Yeah, no, he's played Brazil. It on TV, I think. It's the third film in the series, very popular. And he's married. He's got a husband. Good for him. Pinocchio, another Italian film. This stars Roberto Benigni. It made $6 million this week. And, you know, I always dreaded this movie, but I'm a little relieved because Benigni is not playing Pinocchio. He's playing Geppetto, and I kind of assumed he would be playing Pinocchio and it would just be insufferable. But, you know, maybe as Geppetto, he's off screen a lot. I haven't heard anything about it critic-wise or if it's any good, but I know that's been a passion project for him for quite a while. And number 22 is Startup, that Korean comedy about a loser teen that made another $6 million this week. It's at $12 million. SWAT also made $6 million. That's a Chinese action flick with a dash of comedy. I don't think it has any connection to the U.S. TV series. It's just a SWAT team in China. Black Christmas is a slasher flick here in North America that made another $4 million. That's at $17 million and counting. Right below that is Forbidden Dream, a Korean period drama. I think we've talked about this before, but it seems to have just opened up in Korea. It made $4 million. It's about a commoner who is an innovator and a scientist, and he starts working for a forward-looking king in the 1400s, and he becomes very successful, incurring the jealousy of all the other court officials, since scientists were no better than craftsmen or peasants, as far as they were concerned. But he's a real person, and he invented like a water gauge and a rain gauge and celestial observation tools and helped improve their weaponry. So he was a real guy and suffered at some points, but bounced back because he was so smart. So kind of an interesting drama there, Forbidden Dreams. That opened up and made $4 million in Korea. And right at the bottom of our chart is Ford versus Ferrari. That's just a titch. That's the word of the day. Just a titch under $200 million. So it's struggling a little bit more than I thought to get to $300 million, but it's got a long Oscar season to go. I think it's going to be okay.
Yeah. Now you may be wondering, why did these guys this week spend half an hour talking about 26, for Pete's sake, box office, just give me the top 10 and get out. Well, here's the deal. The reason we spent so much time on box office is because we didn't actually plan to, and we probably weren't minding the clock as usual. But also, this is the time of year where at least 5% of the box office usually comes in North America, if not the world.
That's right. It's a huge week, and we want to cover every new movie that we can. So we don't want to stay focused on the Hollywood films and the North American movies. Whenever there's a new movie on the chart, we do everything we can to figure out what it is, what's it about, because we know people are listening who want to do remakes or English language covers of those films, or maybe pick them up. I've gone to film festivals and had distributors and producers say, hey, let me know if you see a good movie that could be remade. So we want to pay attention to the worldwide box office. That's why we do a worldwide chart. And we want to give full due to movies in Korea and China and Brazil, Italy, wherever they may pop up, so that when they come to North America, you'll be smarter and ready to talk about them. Go, oh, I know that movie. And, you know, we're not done talking. Jojo Rabbit, that passed $20 million in North America. And now it's going to open up in most of the world in January. North America has been its first big territory. It played tons of festivals, did great, opened up in North America, and now pretty quickly it's going to open up in the rest of the world. I feel like this is an example of a worldwide platform release. Now, obviously, in the old days, they would have prints and they'd show them in North America and then ship them to England and then Germany.
Yeah.
And they would travel country by country.
That was a logistics issue.
Right. That was a logistics issue. This is kind of like a platform release in North America, but done on a worldwide scale. Instead of opening up a movie in New York and LA, hoping for good reviews and good buzz and then going wide, this is a movie that opened up in North America and said, all right, And that's a tough market, you know, for an art film or a small little flick like this with an odd little vibe. It's a satire, a black comedy, but they opened up here. They've had great box office, $20 million they just passed, great reviews. It's going to get some Oscar nominations. So now they are ready to go wide, and they are opening up every day in January. It opens up in a new country. So it's really spreading very quickly. And I feel like it's sort of a worldwide platform release. We've had worldwide wide releases a lot. Now we're getting worldwide platform releases where you pick your best country to, you know, make a name for a movie and then go wide. And I think we've probably seen a little bit of this before. I think we'll see more of this down in the future because people are paying attention to the worldwide charts more.
Well, and the reason I mentioned all of that was so that we could mention that this year at the box office worldwide, we very well may cross the $41 billion
mark.
Oh, we have?
Yeah.
Okay, so that means it will be a record year at the worldwide box
office. Oh, is that a record? Because I haven't seen, I've seen them.
Oh, maybe it's not.
No, it's not yet. It may. It's 41 and changed, I think, perhaps, or maybe it's 42.
Okay. So I think 43 is the record.
I don't think we're 2 billion short. That would be a lot, because the international is already a record. The international box office is at a record $30 billion. North America is the second highest grossing year of all time. It's only probably going to end up about 4% down from 2018. So it's going to be like maybe $400 million below from 2018. So if it's not a worldwide record and the final numbers aren't in yet, because we're still making money, it's the 30th. If the final numbers are not in yet, we may be just a tad down, but it's going to be just with a few $100 million short. So
yes,
this is the second highest grossing year of all time for North America. It's a record high for the international box office. Worldwide box office has already passed $41 billion. The box office is very healthy, very strong. This is the fifth straight year the North American box office has tapped $11 billion. This is the 11th year that it's been over $10 billion. So that's the new normal. You're grossing $11 billion. You expect to gross $11 billion next year unless disaster strikes.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the gold ring, the brass ring, if you will, is the $12 billion mark. Can we reach $12 billion?
Absolutely. We've done it $11.8 billion last year. So $12 billion will fall within the next 5 years for sure.
Absolutely.
If not,
I think once Avatar, I think
that'll help a lot. Yeah. And when you have big movies that you know will gross $2 billion, you're like, boom. That gets us a little bit ways there, doesn't it? But you need a lot of movies. You just need Disney to release a movie every day. If they would just release a movie every day and the other studios are saying, please, no. And there's good news coming in 2020. We've talked about all the big movies that are coming out. And in limited release in North America, Just Mercy and Clemency are off to pretty good strong starts. And 1917, that World War I epic, that's off to an excellent start. That's going to be a big film in January.
Yeah, I really want to see that. I know it's gotten, you know, lukewarm reviews where people are.
I've seen lots of good reviews.
Oh, really? Yeah, I mean, I've basically heard, you know, mixed things about it. Like, yes, from the same person will say, oh, yeah, it's like half a great movie. You know, it's like they really want to like it. And there are a few flaws that say just take them right out of the movie. But that said, I wonder if 1917 will play in China on one of the 69,000 screens that now exist there.
Yeah, audiences seem to like 1917 a little bit more than critics, but it scores strongly on Rotten Tomatoes. In China, they have a lot of screens, don't they? But 88,800 were built in 2019. That pace is going to stop, right?
Oh, it has to. I mean,
they are overbooked now.
Yeah, I mean, they're in tier two, tier three cities. I mean, there is no reason for them to keep going until they can figure out whether anybody's going to actually go to any of these movie theaters.
And the other areas that don't have theater screens are not ready for them yet.
I think that's probably true. Although, you know what? I'm sure I could be proven wrong.
I imagine 1917 will play in China, and we know that Marriage Story will. That's a Netflix movie. It's playing mostly Netflix, but since they are blocked from China, they can't offer their service there. They sold off Marriage Story. You know, it's a buyout, and Beijing's Road Pictures picked it up, and they're going to open it up in movie theaters.
Oh, that's good. Well, I mean, it's still playing in movie theaters here in the U.S. I mean, at least in a few theaters here in Los Angeles.
It's never played here in Birmingham, that's for sure. It didn't go wide or anything like that.
No, 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 no.
So most people can see it on Netflix. And, you know, you've heard good buzz and bad buzz about this movie, that movie. I heard bad buzz about AMC. You know why? Because Christmas Day was a Wednesday.
Okay. Which so, means, that, they, you know, they do not control the calendar, right? I can get Adam Aaron on the line, but I don't think he can.
Are you sure? Because they'd like to control the calendar and never have that happen again, because Tuesday was Christmas Eve. And okay. A lot of people showed up at AMC on Tuesday, because every Tuesday is $6 or $5 Tuesday, depending on where you live. They have done that for years now, and they showed up waiting to see their movies for $5, only to find out, oh, no. This is Christmas week and we're not doing that. I'm sure the studios wouldn't have even let them, even if they wanted to, but there were a lot of unhappy people.
Well, technically, the studios don't let them do that anyway. Well, AMC just winds up doing it.
AMC charges $6. I'm sure the studios get their cut of the $6. They don't.
Oh, absolutely. Right. But it's on a per capita.
$9 or anything.
No. It's on a per capita. Right.
But they do it, and they've done it for years, and they did not get the word out that, by the way, $6 Tuesday is not happening on Christmas Eve. And there were a lot of people who were upset because they showed up. You know, they're like, this is awesome. You know, here we go. I'm seeing a lot of new movies. Every Tuesday I go to the movies. And they were pretty disappointed people. They need to do a better job of making sure people know when, you know, Discount Tuesdays is suspended. Because if you're used to going for a matinee at matinee prices and suddenly it's not happening that day because it's Christmas, you're going to be a little angry. You're going to be a little annoyed.
Yeah, you know, I think they're too busy with their streaming service to market.
That's more of a sale-in thing. Well, you know, I don't think it's a big deal, but it is. It does disappoint your customers, and you've let them down a little bit. I would have tossed them a three soda or something. You know, I'd say, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Please have a free small soda on us. Do something to placate them and tell them how badly you feel. And, you know, but I don't know if they did.
Well, if that's not a big deal, I wonder if some of these stories in Big Deal or Big Whoop are a big deal this week. It's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, news and sports, baby. News and sports. That's the story of the year for basic cable. It faces more competition than ever from streaming services, and basic cable found its biggest success by fighting back with live programming. And Donald Trump. Sure, you can tape Rachel Maddow and watch her the next day, but where's the fun in that? That explains why Fox News topped all of basic cable in live plus seven numbers for total viewers, and MSNBC is number two. Not quite breathing down Sean Hannity's neck, but doing very well nonetheless. At number three, guess what? ESPN, with its live sports programming. After that, junk food TV still pulls in people, so spots 4 through 10 include familiar faces like HGTV, I guess that's home gardening television, USA, Hallmark, the History Channel, TLC, the Learning Channel, TBS, and Discovery. Yes, that's a lot of letters, and a lot of home improvement, and a lot of home makeovers, and a lot of learning, but is it a big deal? Or is it a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop because we've known for a while that live programming is TV's last best defense. You know, whether it's network television with their live musicals, or it's cable with, you know, live news events, live, you know, live talk shows and live sports. They've known for a while that's the cure-all. That makes people sit down and watch and see the ads while they're happening. So that's the biggest success story. No surprise there. But yes, there's room for lots of baking shows and home improvement shows because I saw them all over the holidays. Enough already. I don't care if you flip your house. I don't care which home you buy. But I do care about the cookies. Make them nice.
Well, maybe you should just read a book.
I did.
In fact. Well, really? What book did you read?
The Little Women books, all four. I'm writing a review.
Oh, wow. Okay. Wow. Reading the books, seeing the movies. What do you know? Well, listen, once you're done with those books, mm-hmm. Okay, you can go to the library, check out another book.
Oh, I will.
Public libraries in the U.S. face a host of problems when it comes to e-books and major publishers. Libraries are one of the most important buyers of books, but publishers sometimes see them as an enemy rather than its best ally. Now, libraries face a new problem. An outside company called Overdrive provides the crucial backroom support that connects libraries to publishers and their readers. When people check out an e-book online from their local library, it's Overdrive that makes that happen so seamlessly. Well, now Overdrive has been purchased by the private equity firm KKR. That's Kohlberg Kravis Roberts. And they've purchased it for an undisclosed sum. And by the way, private equity firms like to grow a business or flip it to someone else or load it up with debt to extract value. And none of that will be good for libraries. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal because I want to know what their intentions are. It makes me nervous. I know a Japanese company bought Overdrive in 2015 for $410 million. As far as I know, their market share and their positioning hasn't faltered at all. So I don't see why it would sell for any less. I'm not sure why they sold it or what they were planning to do. I'd love to know what KKR's intentions are.
I would love to know, you know, what's really going on inside Overdrive. There's got to be something going on that the Japanese firm is out, that KKR is coming in. And by the way, KKR doesn't always just, you know, liquidate companies or, you know, kind of drive them into the ground. If you look at what they did with Gibson Guitar, yeah, maybe that was their original intention, but they actually helped bring that company out of bankruptcy, replacing its CEO who years earlier had decided, hey, let's turn Gibson into a lifestyle brand, which did not go very well. And they actually helped kind of turn the company around.
Do they make more long-term investments or do they flip and sell or strip them bare? What do they do normally?
It seems like they're making more kind of mid to long-term investments. And you see that with Gibson Guitar. You see that with RB Media. Now, you might say, what the heck is RB Media?
I will. Well, what the heck is RB Media?
Well, they also actually work with libraries for audio content. They do a lot of audio. They're like basically Overdrive's big competitor for audiobooks, for certain.
Overdrive doesn't have a competitor. They are like 90% of the market.
Well, yeah, like I said, by competitor, it's like if there was another one, that would be it.
And I don't know if Overdrive does audio. I know they do digital. I'm not sure that they do audio.
They do audiobooks. You can
Overdrive does.
Yes, it does. Okay. They do. And so, that said, they now own RB Media. They now own Overdrive. They can merge those two. It does seem like Overdrive wants to get into, working with maybe unpublished authors. It does seem like they want to expand. When you read the press notes on this, acquisition, it really does seem like, okay, they're looking to grow a little bit. Maybe that's why they need more capital.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly KKR, they invested $1.25 billion in Epic Games, the publishers of Fortnite.
Was that before Fortnite or after Fortnite?
I think they did that last year, so it was like in the midst of Fortnite.
All right. Well, Sir Sperling, continue with the list.
You know, unfortunately, I hate to tell you this. Unfortunately, I cannot be referred to as Sir once again this year, unfortunately.
Oh.
In fact, the two Johns, Elton and Olivia Newton-John, that is, are both being honored by Queen Elizabeth II. Her New Year's honors list includes Sir Elton John now being named a Companion of Honor, and only 65 people in the world can be Companions of Honor at the same time. Olivia Newton-John will be Dame Olivia for her work with charities, cancer research, and entertainment. Also on the list for various honors, director Sam Mendes.
The director of 1917.
That's right. And Steve McQueen, the director of 12 Years a Slave. Mm-hmm. Graphic designer Peter Saville, who created album covers for Joy Division and New Order. Drummer Roger Taylor of Queen. And even Billy Ocean, which again, hello, do you not have our address? Seriously, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's the definition of a big whoop. As Karen would say, guy or gal gets title. Move on. But you know, Billy Ocean represents the Caribbean, I believe. Isn't he?
That's right. Yeah. He does.
And even not just the song Caribbean Queen, but in fact the region. So that's you know, showing the empire or the vestiges of the empire that England once had. It's funny, most of the people here are specifically being honored first and foremost for their charitable work, for the things they have done beyond their artistic achievements. It's not enough to say, oh, Elton John, good songs. No, apparently it's the raising of money to fight AIDS and things like that they want to honor, even though, of course, they're all big figures in entertainment. Very cool to see the graphic designer Peter Saville in there. He has done great album covers for Joy Division and New Order and other people. Very cool to see someone like that get recognized as well.
Well, you know, I just wonder, maybe Billy Ocean is there because the Queen wanted to know if they're sharing the same dream. And you can look up Billy Ocean.
Oh my God. Don't
figure that one out.
Keep going.
All right. Well,
I have a joke and I'm going to walk all over it.
That's true. I'm going to try. But you know what? If you do want to look up those lyrics, you can do it on Spotify. Because Facebook.
Okay.
See what I was doing there? I was getting us into the next story. Mm-hmm. You thought I was stepping on my own joke.
I thought you were Frank Sinatra trying to tell a joke. But anyway.
No. Okay. So let's talk about Spotify. Unlike Facebook, They looked at the income from political ads and decided, you know, they aren't really worth the bother. The music streaming service announced it was suspending political ads in early 2020 because it's just not confident it can properly vet them. It may do so again sometime in the future, you know, run them if that is, but not this election cycle in the U.S. Spotify, by the way, has never run political ads in the rest of the world. In contrast, Facebook said political ads are a pittance of its overall income, but it felt morally obliged to be an open platform and must continue to knowingly spread lies and misinformation about everything from anti-vax nonsense to lies about candidates running for president of the United States. I mean, they're just going to let anybody post anything, effectively. That's their thing.
That's actually their company model as far as individuals.
You know, there's also truths posted there, but, you know, the lies get a heck of a lot more play. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop because Spotify wasn't a big player. I know Bernie Sanders advertised with them. I believe, I forget the conservative group that does too. It might be Trump. It might not be. But yeah, there were people who were certainly advertising on Spotify and found it a valuable platform. That's gone. But since nobody else is going to be on there either, I think it's a wash.
Yeah, and
because you can reach people on Spotify who are probably more, you're probably more likely to reach a younger, hipper audience that's harder to reach elsewhere. So maybe that does hurt the Dems a little bit more.
Oh, good point. I think that, you know, in England or Sweden or other countries in general, where elections are, I don't know off the top of my head, I'd have to say normal, where you don't spend like three years in an election cycle.
System, it's different.
Yeah, well, that said, the campaigning here, I mean, billions of dollars are spent on it, whereas in other countries, it's 6 weeks and it's over. So
right,
you don't have time to spend
all that. 3 months later, there's another one. And then nine months later, there's another. There's flaws in both.
Yeah, true.
All right, let's move on to inside baseball.
I say we should definitely, because there are so many flaws, we should separate ourselves from Europe.
Good idea. Now it's time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
Well, here's how this story is going to affect you. You are not going to see YouTube or Facebook producing any original content, or at least very little.
They're spending $1 billion each on original content. They're just not spending as much as the other guys. No, they are committing lots of money. They are just not going to become streaming services that charge a subscription. They're going to
create
content, but they're not playing the game that others are, saying, hey, let's spend billions and billions of dollars and let's charge money for it. So they are both giants in tech and media, and they both have struggled with streaming video and what their role should be. Both are part of FANG. Those are the huge players in tech and media. And
that's Facebook, mm-hmm. Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. So that's what FANG stands for.
Google could be referred to by its parent company, Alphabet, in which case the name would be FAN. I'm a fan of those FANGs. You know, I don't know. I just think it could be FAN.
Let me explain that joke for you people. You see, I'm just kidding.
All right. Both.
You didn't stop me there. There I was not even making a joke and you didn't even stop me.
Both have toyed with streaming video and possibly launching subscriptions with ad-free content. Both now spend about $1 billion a year on content, which is a lot of money, but not anywhere near Netflix and Amazon and those.
But I have to point out, Michael, when you say they're spending $1 billion on content, if you look at YouTube, they actually went out, they created a whole bunch of series. Right. They had but then they got rid of them and they said, yeah, we'll spend $1 billion, but we're going to give that to people that are already creating content and partner with them rather than go out and create shows from scratch. Basically,
Google launched, YouTube Red. It was an ad free level at $12 a month. They had shows like Cobra Kai, the spinoff from The Karate Kid. They funded a Kirsten Dunst show that's now airing on Showtime and got nominated for awards. But they pulled back from all that and said, you know what? This doesn't make sense. People don't want to pay when they're on YouTube. We're going to embrace ads. We're going to make all our programming available to everyone. You're just going to have to watch some ads, right? What did Facebook do?
Well,
they stuck to free content. They have Facebook Watch. They never planned, really. They didn't quite know what works or what to do, and they're still throwing.
Well, they went out and they bought sports, remember?
Yeah, they're throwing you know, they're throwing content at the wall to see what sticks, basically. They have some live sports. They have the Real World reboot. They have Sorry for Your Loss, which has been a big hit, a show about the grieving process of all things. But they found out that the shows that work best are shows that have a community around them where people can watch the show and immediately talk, you know, my dad died this year, or this is what we did when my mom got sick, you know. So this shows that start a conversation, which is what everyone wants to do. But on Facebook, it's a natural fit because you love the Real World. You're watching it on Facebook. Oh my God, did you see what Joey just did to Susie? Or did you, I can't believe Tommy broke up with Bobby, or whatever it may be. You can comment and do it right there on the platform you are. And that's what Facebook and YouTube want. They want you to stay on Facebook and YouTube. They don't want you to go to Netflix and watch something because maybe you'll never come back.
You know, I've really got very little to add to this.
Well, everyone has a different reason to be in the streaming wars. So what are those reasons? Netflix? What's their reason?
Well, Netflix, that's their whole, you know, raison d'etre. I mean, what else do they do other than, you know, provide content to consumers?
Right. Facebook.
They did it on DVD first, and now they're doing it through streaming. Facebook, you know, ultimately they are there to connect people, and they have like 2 billion, like half the world's population practically. Mm-hmm. And I know I'm exaggerating, but they have a platform in which people can connect and share things. That is why people are there. They are not an entertainment company.
But the longer you stay there, the happier they are. And therefore, if they can keep you by there by watching some videos like the upcoming Steve Harvey show, they'll be happy. What about Amazon?
Well, Amazon, I would like to sell you, what's the word I'm looking for? Oh, everything. They literally want to sell it, and they will get it to you the next day or in an hour.
And first, what do they want to sell you first?
Well, they want to sell you what? Like Amazon Prime,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. So they want you to
sell you a membership.
Annual fee. You get some free programming, get overnight shipping, and suddenly you're buying your toilet paper from them.
Correct.
What about Apple? What are they? Why are they showing original content?
Well, they're kind of, they started off as a hardware company, right? It was all about the iPods and the Macs, and it was all tangible hardware. Slowly, they've become a service company. So now they're kind of a cross between a hardware and a service company. But that's really why, you know what? You can watch Apple Plus on Apple TV.
Right. And the lure is just, oh, hey, buy our product and you get access to some free cool shows. It's just sort of an add-on extra, which is how much money they have. They're spending all this money. And really, it's just, hey, keep buying our computers and phones.
Right. Precisely.
Right.
Keep buying our iPhones.
So I think Facebook and YouTube realize, you know what? They are in their DNA, free services. People do not expect to spend money when they go to Facebook or YouTube. Forget about the digital currency, by the way, Facebook. And so they realize they couldn't compete with everyone else, and it's not their game. And that game's getting tougher thanks to Disney Plus, HBO Max, Peacock, and on and on and on. We linked to an article in Variety about all of this. It's a good article. There's one thing in there that I take issue with. It cites a knowledgeable source that claims tens of millions of people have subscribed to YouTube Premium at $12 a month.
What? How is that possible?
No way. Because if tens of millions of people had subscribed, A, they would be telling us, and B, they would not have shut down YouTube Premium. They'd be thrilled. You know,
they would be doing is hiring a development staff to start stocking.
Well, they had one. They fired them all. They didn't fire the head of it, but she's been very upset because she was playing the game and looking to get Emmy nominations and create great content. And suddenly they canceled stuff and sent things packing. So they haven't fired everyone, but they had great content. They had people work and develop it. So tens of millions, that just simply cannot be true. I don't buy it.
Well, I feel sorry for all those shows that were at YouTube there were some. Yeah, that kind of, were put into turnaround or died, like Don Imus, in fact. And, you know, people outside I'm sorry?
He wasn't at YouTube?
No. I'm just mentioning that Don Imus died.
Oh, he died at 79. That's right.
Yeah, and for those outside of the U.S., you may not know who he is. He is a radio, I guess in the U.S., he's a legend, really.
Absolutely. He's a shock jock. He longed to offend, and he usually succeeded. But he also did some good stuff. Like most people, he's complex. He raised money for charities, namely for wounded veterans and kids with cancer. He would have kids come to his home ranch every summer or maybe all year long. I don't know. But they hosted kids there a lot. Kind of a crazy career. In high school, he was impeached as class president. He was fired from his first radio gig for saying the word hell on air. Oh, my goodness.
And then, those were the days.
Those were the days. Then he launched Imus in the Morning, a smash hit syndicated show from New York. He did stand-up. He cut albums. You know, the time sort of passed him by. Unlike Howard Stern, who was a shock jock but learned to evolve and grew up a little bit, Don Imus never grew up, and he really got in hot water for calling the Rutgers women's basketball team a racial slur. It was just the final straw after decades of ugly comments. He repeatedly had to leave the air, go to a new company, always making money. Someone else news was always willing to pick him up. And at the end, that was Fox Big Business Network. No surprise there. He ended after 50 years on the air in March of 2018, apologizing again for that horribly racist comment about young women who were just representing their college honorably in competition. So he has a blot on his career, but that's not the only blot. He had a lifetime of saying nasty, ugly things. It was sort of a shtick. But he did do some good as well. I never listened to him, never cared about him, but I think he's won like three of the key radio personality awards like three times, which no one else has done. He is certainly a major figure in talk radio.
And a major figure on Broadway was Jerry Herman, without a doubt.
Hello, I mean, Jerry.
Yeah, well, it was more like Hello, Dolly and La Cage aux Folles.
And Mame. That's right. Yeah. Died at 88. He wrote simple, hummable tunes. They were easy to remember. Ka-ching! You know, some people say, no, he is not the opposite of Sondheim. Sondheim wrote memorable melodies, and Jerry Herman wrote complex songs. Sure, fine, okay, fair enough. However, Jerry Herman had huge hits, while Stephen Sondheim mostly did not. His shows have done better in revivals than they ever did originally. Sondheim had a lot of shows that struggled to make money. Jerry Herman had three big shows and a couple other nice solid hits. Milk and Honey was his first breakthrough after some off-Broadway debuts. Then he did Hello Dolly with producer David Merrick. That won the Tony for Best Musical. Then he did Mame, which was almost as big a hit. That was with Angela Lansbury. Then he did Mac and Mabel, a classic flop, a beloved show starring Bernadette Peters and Robert Preston that just did not make it. It broke his heart. It was revived again. It flopped again. It was revived in London. It flopped again. And now they're doing it in February in New York City at Encore. So it has yet another chance, but it's a great score.
Wait. I think I know how it ends.
Ooh, we don't know.
It flops again.
We don't know.
Okay.
For a weekend or two weekends. So we'll have to.
Okay.
He got so dispirited after those two massive hits, Hello Dolly and Mame, were monsters. After he had three or four shows that flopped, he got so depressed, he quit Broadway and went to work as an interior designer, which is another way of saying he was openly gay. And then he came back with La Cage aux Folles, the best musical, and it's been revived twice, and it's won Best Revival twice, the only show in history to win the Tony every time it's been on Broadway, in, you know, for three times. Best musical, wow. Revival, Best Revival again. They love it. They love that show. He did Jerry's Girls, another review that toured the country forever. You know the songs, Hello Dolly, We Need a Little Christmas, Before the Parade Passes By, and I Am What I Am. He's the first composer, and really he was a composer lyricist, but the first guy to create Broadway shows who had three of them that ran 1,500 plus performances on Broadway. Big, big hits, very talented guy, and now he's gone.
Well, and think about it this way. Louis Armstrong sang Hello Dolly.
Yes, he did. Along with Barbra Streisand and 1,000 other people.
Yeah, no, meaning like, you know, think about how far back that is.
Oh, okay, there you go. Yeah, well, Streisand's still here too. But yeah, no, it's from the 60s to today. You know, he's had La Cage aux Folles was on Broadway in the 10s, I think, just 5 or 8 years ago.
Well, now also passing away was Lee Mendelson, a producer of all those Peanuts specials that, Christmas time is here, bringing lots of cheer. You know, remember that those lyrics?
But not for his family, of course. His entire career revolved around the remarkable success of the TV special A Charlie Brown Christmas. It was quiet, slow-paced, a little sad, didn't include a laugh track, had the voices of kids voicing the kids on the show, had a little children's choir that sang off-key. It was like you at your high school hearing kids sing these songs. And it featured melancholy jazz music. And, of course, it was a massive hit. No one, of course, thought it would be. CBS was astonished as anyone. And now it's aired every year since and sort of, one of the early shows that defined the Christmas holiday season. He produced a lot of Peanut TV specials and other animated specials like Kathy and Garfield, spinoffs from those comic strips. He won multiple Emmys in the process. And after an illness, he died on Christmas Day. Now, isn't that perfect? I mean, his family's like, it sucks for us, but it's kind of a touching way for him to go out. And like you mentioned, the lyrics to Christmas Time is Here. He wrote those lyrics. He tried to find someone to write lyrics for a melody and dashed them off at the last second when they couldn't find anyone. So that's a standard, you know. Louis Armstrong's probably sung that. I know Ray Charles has, and Willie Nelson, and lots of people.
Well, I'll never forget my daughter when she first heard Louis Armstrong. She's like, "What is wrong with this guy? He can't sing at all." I said, "Well, it's Louis Armstrong. That's he's known for that voice." She said, "Didn't he land on the moon?"
Oof.
I mean, she was young at the time.
Fair enough.
So in her defense, the fact that she even knew who Neil Armstrong was.
But his song is inherently appealing. I don't understand his voice, I mean. I'm surprised that she would think it was awful.
It wasn't one of his standard he was doing a live performance was a recording.
I can understand her going, "What the hell is that?" You know, "What a Wonderful World," you know. Come on.
No, yeah. It wasn't that song.
I know.
It wasn't that song.
Well, she's got a lot to learn and we've got a lot to learn. It's going to be a brand new year next year. Will there be a show next week?
I believe so, yes.
Oh, well, there will be a show next week, but there will not be, of course, the legendary Parisian bookstore is coming to an end, isn't it? What's it called? The Quiet Death? Tell us about the email from one of our listeners.
So CJ Flynn from D Cinema Test Tool sent us two emails over the past week. One was about a bookstore in Paris that was
also known as the Crossed Bridge.
Yes, Le Pont Traverse.
Oui.
Traversé.
Oh, oui.
It's closing down. It's a legendary bookstore in
Paris. Absolutely. I forget the neighborhood it was in. I won't even try to say the word. But it's a beloved bookstore known for its poetry selection, known for its iconoclastic owner. It was a former butcher shop. It was just a place you had to go to when you visited Paris. And very sad to see it go, but, you know, she had a great run and she's just saying, "I'm done." And the rent is too much and no one else will take it over and keep it the same. So to heck with it. I'm walking away. And now, of course, it's getting lots of attention. And she says, "Where were you 10 years ago when I needed you? So go away. No interviews. Leave me alone. I'm Parisian."
Right, pretty much. Basically, she did the same thing that when Conan O'Brien was being thrown off the Tonight Show, saying, you know, if all those people that were complaining that Conan O'Brien was being thrown off the Tonight Show would actually watch, he probably wouldn't be thrown off the Tonight Show.
Yeah, that's right. But when one bookstore closes, another one opens.
Yes, just not in Paris, unfortunately, because CJ sent us another article about a bookstore in Tokyo that sounds absolutely fascinating. You could spend all day there without buying a thing. In fact, although here's the catch. You got to pay $13 to get in.
Well, that's okay. You get free coffee or tea. You can wander and read all you want, and you're sure to find something you love. So it's a funny little twist, but it's not the first place to do that, is it?
There's a bookstore in Lisbon, if that's the one you're referring to.
That's right. And the J.K. Rowling, when she lived there, long before the Harry Potter books, she used to frequent that place, and it was one of the things that helped inspire some of the locations in her books.
You know, that is kind of true. That's more of a legend that she frequented. She went in there and she saw the staircase, and many believe that was the inspiration for the moving staircases inside this like 2 or 3 story bookstore in Porto, in Portugal. But it's, you know, whether she worked it, people say, "Oh, she wrote half of
Harry." Wrote it in England. No, I didn't think she wrote it there. No, she wrote it in, there's a special cafe in London where she would just park her carriage, her baby carriage, and get to work, and they let her sit there for hours and nurse her coffee or tea. I forget what she drank. But yeah, that was in the UK, of course, after she came back.
Yes. Now, the cloaks, this bookstore started charging admission in 2015, because so many people were going into it in Porto and not buying anything. So they said, "We have too many people in the store not buying anything. The people that do want to buy stuff can't get in. So let's charge an admission." And it's like €5 or something like that. And so they will take that €5 and apply it to anything you want to buy in the store.
Ah,
so you're actually
while you're there.
While you're there, correct.
Okay.
And so across from that bookstore, literally across the street, is the University of Porto that is known for having these black capes for its students.
Okay.
Well, guess what? There's the black capes from...
There are many black capes in many...
Yes, but that's supposedly where she got the... She has said it was the University of Porto students that gave me the idea for the capes.
Well, all right. Gryffindor. So Harry Potter lives on, our show lives on, a new year lives on, but we have to say goodbye.
That's true. But you can subscribe to our show on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find our show in your podcast catcher or aggregator, please do rate and review the shows in any one of those spots. It does help us out when you do. Links to all of those ways to subscribe to us, as well as all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That is also where you will find ways to contact us. Again, you can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter, at @ShowbizSandbox is our handle. We're also on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. We have a website at showbizsandbox.com. They have a website. It's whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's Hello Dolly, but Goodbye Jerry.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry on that website, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated? Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.